Welcome to Wilmot Dixon's podcast channel, Building Knowledge. Today's podcast comes in the form of an audio version of a webinar we recently held on the topic of the new biodiversity net gain legislation. It's fair to say it's a topic that's been subject to much debate and deliberation over recent months, while the government has been finalising the exact requirements. It was great to see the enforcement date of the 12th of February come out recently, and I trust this recording will go some way in helping you to navigate it. We're going to take a deep dive into the topic and talk about the legislation itself, as well as how it relates to construction projects. So let's get into it.
So let's introduce you to the team. So we've got Jono and Simone from Wilmot Dixon's sustainability team here, and we've got Alice, Ben and Laura from EMEC, one of our partner ecologists. So today, this is a quick overview of what we're going to be running through, and we'll get through it as succinctly as possible for you. At the front end, EMEC will be running through the legislation and what it means. Then in the second half, we'll have Simone talk through how it relates to construction and share some tips on how to get started and advice on adherence. So that's enough for me. Let's get started.
So I'm John Ayton from Wilmot Dixon, and I'm going to sort of talk you through a little bit about the burning platform now. So think about that video. The key bits I take from it is that biodiversity is essential to life, for us to succeed and for us to thrive. You know, we need trees to lock away carbon. We need plants for our medicines and sea plants to help mitigate against sea level rise. We know it's important, yet all those stats of wildlife reduction and the rate at which it's happening is really terrifying. So David picked out that key point that we focus on a lot. We focus on climate change a lot, and rightly so. But biodiversity is equally, if not just as important. I look more and think about the UK and see that we've already lost half of our biodiversity. And we're the worst performing of the G7 countries. The evidence from the last 50 years shows that the intensive way in which we manage our land for farming and the continuing effects of climate change are the two biggest drivers of biodiversity loss. I found a quote from the RSPB's chief exec, which said the UK's wildlife is better studied than in any other country in the world. And what the data tells us should make us sit up and listen. So we know we have a real problem. You don't need me to tell you that. And we know that construction is one of the industries that unfortunately contributes to the decline of biodiversity. As the buildings we build directly impact or affect biodiversity, whether that's on a green land or brown land site. Our activities can have a harmful impact on the environment, but they don't have to. And that links back to what David said at the end of the video, where he summed it up perfectly, along with the epic music, by stating we already know exactly what to do. We just need to do it and do it faster. And that leads us nicely to today. So thank you. Thank you for joining us. It's great to have so many of you here as we tackle an issue bigger than all of us, and arguably one we can only achieve through collaboration and sharing of best practice. Now, fortunately, as Louise mentioned, there's a new requirement coming through legislation imminently, I hope, called Biodiversity Net Gain, or BNG. It's going to come into force in England this February and will impact the way we do our projects. Now, I'm really excited for the team to share some of the work we've been doing at Wilmot Dixon. We launched our Now and Ever sustainability strategy 4 years ago now. And with it, a raft of ambitious targets and commitments, one being for all our projects to start calculating biodiversity. So we've been doing BNG for a number of years, and we've been working closely with our ecology experts, and they've been guiding us on how we can best support you to achieve BNG on your projects. I also think the narrative has changed now. It's no longer just about planting some trees to tick a box, but rather we are designing homes, schools, universities to embrace biodiversity, to be designed with biodiversity in mind. The benefits of that go far beyond just, you know, carbon reduction or air pollution. It improves communities. Nature, or access to nature, has been proven to increase well-being and support productivity. Yeah, there's so many benefits we all know about. We just got to do it. So I think we're really placed, all of us now, to design and build buildings that deliver biodiversity net gain and create amazing places to live. And I, for one, am really excited to see how this new legislation will change the narrative. So before I waffle on too much, I'd like to hand you over to the team to talk you through BNG in more detail and how it impacts you and how we will support you on the journey. Thank you.
Hi everybody, I'm Laura from EMEC and I'm an ecologist. I'll be talking through biodiversity net gain and the metric for you.
Yeah, and I'm Ben Jones, a senior project manager And I'll be talking through some habitat interventions and what the construction and the maintenance of them will look like on the ground.
Okay, so what is biodiversity net gain? If we split it up, biodiversity is the variety of plant and animal life in the world or particular habitat, a high level of which is usually considered to be important and desirable. Net gain is overall gain rather than loss or maintenance of what is currently there. And biodiversity net gain is an approach to development that aims to leave the natural environment in a measurably better state than it was beforehand. The legislation, as Jono mentioned, is due to come in on 12th of February. Schedule 7A, grants of planning permission in England to be subject to a condition to secure that the biodiversity gain objective is met. And the biodiversity gain objective is met if the biodiversity value attribute to the development exceeds the pre-development biodiversity value of the on-site habitat by at least the relevant percentage. So that relevant percentage is 10%. So it's important to note that the 12th of February date is just expected for the regular metrics. So the expected date for small sites is April 2024 and for nationally significant infrastructure projects or NSIPs in 2025. Some exceptions from BNG, such as household conversions, permitted development, development impacting less than 25 metres squared of habitat or less than five metres of hedgerow. I'll explain a bit later about what the small sites metric is. Okay, so we've got the first myth buster for you. So the new requirements apply to all construction projects regardless of scale. So true or false? So we had 60% voting false and 40% voting true. So it is false. The new requirements don't apply to small sites currently, and NSIPs, so the requirements for those types of developments will come statutory in the future. So the minimum 10% net gain required calculating using biodiversity metric and approval of net gain plan by the LPA. So the requirement for the 10% as calculated within the biodiversity metric, it's the minimum statutory requirement. Some LPAs may require higher than 10% BNG as part of their local policy. The standard metric is the DEFRA metric, which is periodically revised, or the DEFRA small sites metric, which you can see on there. So the small sites metric can be used for residential sites less than a hectare or less than 10 proposed properties. Or less than half a hectare if the number of the dwellings isn't known. And also non-residential sites less than 1,000 square metres floor space or the site area less than a hectare. There are some instances where the small sites metric can't be used. So if you've got priority habitats present on site and then European protected species, so bats, GCN, great crested newts. Sorry, used to using the shorter version. If off-site interventions are required, so you can't use small site metric if you have to get net gain by using off-site interventions. Some priority habitats include ponds, higher quality grasslands, and wet woodland. Just one more point on the metrics. Sorry, there is a Warwickshire. Another metric in Warwickshire. It had its own metric that takes into account location-specific variances. The LPA will usually dictate which metric they require to be used, and a full BNG assessment will be needed to be undertaken before planning will be granted to evidence that the minimum 10% net gain will be achieved and maintained. 30-year management plan will also be required to demonstrate how 10% net gain will be achieved and maintained, and this may be required before planning is granted or as a condition. Okay. So requirements of BNG. So the habitat will be secured for at least 30 years via obligations and a conservation covenant. And it's the responsibility of the developer or the landowner to ensure that habitat management is carried out, for at least those 30 years. So any land that is part of, be it biodiversity net gain, is locked into that 30-year management plan. And it also can't be used for another development. So if you use a piece of land for one biodiversity net gain calculation for one site, that land then can't be used again for a different site. A conservation covenant is a private voluntary agreement between a landowner and a responsible body, such as a conservation charity, government body, or a local authority. It delivers lasting conservation benefit for public good and sets out obligations in respect of the land, which will be legally binding not only on the landowner, but on subsequent owners of the land, as I mentioned before. Okay. Okay, so DEFRA metric is 4.0 used for this example, and put it into a table for you. It's widely used to quantify BNG. So when you carry out a BNG or BIA calculation, you input information on baseline and proposed habitats. The first thing that you'd put in is the habitat type. So it's based on UK Habs, UK habitat classification methodology. The habitat area, so it's hectares for habitat and kilometres for linear features. If you're using a small sites metric, they use metres. The metric then automatically categorises the habitat distinctiveness. This is a measure of the value, and it determines the efforts needed for the replacement of the habitat, some of which are irreplaceable. I'll come on to that a little bit later. You then also need to input habitat condition. So this is your habitat is basically assessed against a set of condition criteria, which is different for each habitat type. Then the strategic significance. This is whether your habitat is important locally, so it's included within a local strategy, or it's a site within a local biodiversity strategy area, or if the habitat is important within the setting it's in. So for example, if that habitat forms a connectivity to another similar habitat, it would be classed as important. Trading rules. This is where some, I'm just trying to see which bit I had on the screen. Trading rules. So yeah, distinctiveness determines the compensation required for your habitat. So this ties in to the how it automatically categorizes the habitat distinctiveness. If you have a low distinctiveness habitat, so modified grassland, cropland, or urban habitat, then the metric only requires same distinctiveness habitat or better. Whereas for high distinctiveness habitats, so heathland or reed beds, then you would require the same habitat type. As I mentioned earlier, some habitats are irreplaceable. So that means that you would need bespoke compensation. The metric uses this information then to calculate the unit value of each habitat and compares the baseline and post-intervention units to calculate your net gain or net loss, so the change in those numbers. Okay. So the requirements of BNG. This habitat delivery hierarchy is a hierarchy. So on site is what is going to be your priority. So it must be justified that BNG cannot be carried out on site before then off site can be considered. And same again for purchase of statutory biodiversity credits. So the developer will have to prove that net gain cannot be carried out on site or off site before they'll have to prove it to the LPA before they'll be able to purchase credits. So purchase credits is a last resort and it can be very expensive. The developer will have to prove, they'll have to prove it that they can use it. Cost of the credits varies depending on the distinctiveness of the habitats. So as you can see there, cost of credits, 42,000 to 650,000. So that is 42,000 for low distinctiveness habitats, so modified grassland urban habitats, such as introduced scrub gardens, going all the way up then to 650,000 for your higher distinctiveness habitats, such as heathland, wet woodland, and more of the rarer grassland types. There is also a spatial risk multiplier. So this incentivizes purchase of credits within the same LPA, local planning authority. If you're purchasing credits within the same LPA, you get one credit per unit. Then if you're purchasing, if the units are in adjacent LPAs or LCAs, they're worth 0.75. And units in non-adjacent LPAs or NCAs are worth 0.5. So they are worth less if they're in non-adjacent or adjacent LPAs to your site. And then, yeah, a National Register for Net Gain Delivery Sites is available online. Okay, so the mitigation hierarchy still applies. First is avoidance, then mitigation, and then compensation via biodiversity loss. So avoidance is your priority. You want to avoid that. You want to avoid impacts to any habitats. Then is mitigation. So if you do have to damage habitats or remove habitats, then you mitigate for that change via net gain. So replacing any habitats. Lastly is compensation for biodiversity loss. So this also applies to nationally significant infrastructure projects. And I mentioned earlier, irreplaceable habitats. So these require bespoke compensation. Examples of irreplaceable habitats are things like ancient woodland, ancient and veteran trees, blanket bogs, limestone pavements, coastal sand dunes, Spartina salt marsh swards, I hope I've said that correctly, Mediterranean salt marsh scrub, and lowland fens. So the 10% gain is not applicable to irreplaceable habitats because these valuable habitats cannot easily be recreated and enhanced. They're still recorded within the metric, but it flags up that bespoke compensation is required. So this is an example of a BNG in action. This is a housing development. So this, what you're seeing here on the screen, is what you create in the GIS package that you use for the DEFRA metric. So the one on the left with all the sort of green and not as much red is the baseline. And then the one on the right is the proposed habitats. So on the baseline there, you've got modified grassland in poor condition, that dominates the site, woodland stand in poor condition, patches of bramble scrub, the condition of this isn't applicable, patches of ruderal vegetation, some scattered trees in good condition, and then artificial and developed land, ground level planters, introduced shrub and vegetated gardens. And on the proposed habitats one, we were creating woodland retained and enhanced to moderate condition by removing invasive and non-native species, planting gaps with native species, leaving deadwood in situ and allowing the wood to mature. And then the scrub was enhanced to mixed scrub in moderate condition by planting gaps with native species and pruning to maintain an age range. Then creating a verge of modified grassland in moderate condition by sowing a meadow seed mix and mowing to manage wildflowers. Planting of native trees and native hedges. And finally, just a note on vegetated gardens. So any private gardens that will be managed by private landowners and will be under residential curtilage, they must be classified as vegetated garden rather than the proposed individual habitats. As their condition habitat type and longevity can't be guaranteed. So this development here really kind of highlights the importance of involving an ecologist early on in the development process. We were able to add all of those things that I listed as enhancements to improve the net gain on this site. So in this case, there was a large net loss for the original proposal, and there was a lot of consultation between us and the client, and several iterations of the metrics were required to achieve 10% net gain. So an early baseline assessment can highlight areas with high biodiversity value so that the development can be designed to minimize the loss of units on site.
Yeah, so thanks for that, Laura. So moving on to the next slide, I'm going to be talking about some of our habitat interventions and the construction methodologies and the maintenance and how we actually carry out those interventions. So up on the screen there, the photo on the left is construction using a bentonite liner for a pond. So bentonite, if you're not familiar with the material, it creates basically a membrane that will stop, will hold the water within the pond, and you backfill about 300 mil worth of material over the top of it that you can then plant into. So it gives a real nice natural finish on a pond. And one of the other techniques we can use for pond building is using clay. So that's either clay that we can get from the site, or we'll bring some onto the site and you compact it and puddle it, and then that will hold water on top itself. And so on either of those two construction methods, you end up with the similar sort of maintenance on them. And the main thing that we're looking for is to keep invasive species out of there. So that could be Canadian pondweed or bulrush. And that's just handballed out of there by getting in there in waders and pulling the material out of there. And then even with any sort of species, even the non-invasive species, we like to maintain between 20 and 30% open water. And onto another type of intervention is creating grasslands. And so that's a really easy sort of intervention that we can do on sites. Substituting amenity grass seeds for meadow grass seeds. And it's quite a low intensity way of constructing grasslands. You just fluff up the soil, basically rotivate it, and then do the seeding. And one day's labor, you can do about 1,000 meter squares that we've done on a recent project. In terms of maintenance, again, really basic maintenance, mowing it once a year, mowing late, and then doing herbicide treatments on spot herbicide treatments of weeds. Yeah, so moving on to tree planting, probably something that all of us are very familiar with and we're used to doing on sites. There have been some quite high profile industry cases of just really high failure rates, basically, where the trees don't take. So we can't really stress the importance of maintenance on tree planting enough, because it is being picked up on across the industry when trees fail. So the type of maintenance that we'd be looking to do is replacement of failed trees 1 year post-planting. So if your planting contractor is pricing the work, asking them to ensure that they're pricing in to do a beat-up survey, counting the number of failed trees a year afterwards and then replacing them. And another point which is easily missed, people plant their trees and move on from the site usually as one of the last things to do, is coming back in about 3 years post-planting and removing the tree guards. Now there's 101 different types of tree guards out there. They could be biodegradable, photodegradable, they could be cardboard, they could be some type of plastic, but they're not great to be leaving on the ground. Even once the trees have grown, they just kind of strangle the trunk of the tree and sit there. And the tree might grow fine, but it's not great to look at. So around 3 years post-planting, getting back in there and removing all those tree guards. So hopefully this will be a familiar project to some on the call. It was done under the SCAPE framework, and EMEC were involved as a sub-consultant throughout the design, development and the pre-construction phase. Our parent company, Nottinghamshire Wildlife Trust, had released a green vision for the site, and we were invited by the client to become involved with the project and help achieve some of the objectives identified in that. Yeah, moving on to the next slide, it just touches on how we managed to achieve that. So there's the broad vision for the site. We did a hell of a lot of stakeholder engagement, both with people directly involved in the project, the main consultants, the clients and the designers. And we also managed to, because of our early involvement, when issues arose, we were able to bring in additional specialist resource as the project required. And so you can see the marsh area towards the bottom of the site there. We were able to bring in hydrological resource to do a water balance study and overcome some issues during the design process through doing that. Getting a good ecologist on board nice and early allows them to take a pragmatic approach. They can appreciate the scale and the size of major projects, and the high volume of change that can happen. And they can consider the impacts on the overall program. And then we've managed to deliver positive outcomes for the client. So a really good design has been developed, and we're confident that that design is sympathetic of the wildlife in the local area. Yeah, and so I'll hand over now to Simone, who'll talk about biodiversity and net gain and how that can impact us.
Thank you, Ben. Yes, so I will be talking about how biodiversity net gain is going to impact you. So our journey so far with biodiversity net gain as Wilmot Dixon. So we've been, as Jono mentioned earlier on, we've been on this journey for quite a while of our now or never strategy, because we would like to deliver environmental net gain on all of our projects. So in order to do that, we have been trialing the DEFRA metric on all of our projects to try and work out the best way to actually deliver BNG, which has given us great expertise in it and the opportunity to understand, you know, where we're going to be able to achieve it, what the best process might be for that, and help inform our customers as well, as well as getting the right advice from consultants like EMEC, of course. So it's also really important to think about, you know, how we can support you from our expertise with this journey so far and making sure that we are delivering those environmental net gain benefits. So the flood protection and improved air quality and things that we're trying to achieve through that. So getting started with biodiversity net gain, as we said, you're going to want to have some early engagement with the contractor to understand where the opportunities for BNG are on your site. Next, you're going to want to think about the design and the budget of the scheme and making sure you're incorporating BNG opportunities into those, making sure that all things have been considered within them. Then the contractor will appoint professionals such as EMEC to advise on BNG and engage stakeholders like local green space owners to look at how you can best deliver that BNG with your on-site, off-site options. And then you want to build BNG into existing baseline ecology surveys, ensure that the design changes don't impact the BNG throughout the process of the design, because, you know, it's going to become much more difficult if you start losing parts of the landscaping. Then you want to make sure you're applying the mitigation hierarchy, which I'll come on to in a moment, and follow the good practice principles, which I'll also come on to in a moment. And then finally, you want to deliver the BNG amongst other benefits, such as the environmental net gain benefits, like I said, with the flood protection. And then you want to make sure you're publicizing your work as well. So giving the opportunity for other people to learn from what you've done and share that best practice so that we can all make the best difference that we can. So the 10 best practice principles. So we start with applying the mitigation hierarchy, which Laura did mention. So we want to avoid any impacts, and then mitigate and offset. Then number two, avoid losing any biodiversity that cannot actually be offset elsewhere. So thinking about things like ancient woodlands, priority habitats, those like special habitats that you can't actually offset because they're going to be too important. Number three, be inclusive and equitable. So you want to make sure you're including stakeholders in any of those discussions and plans. Number four, address risks. So thinking about the current conditions and the habitats that are actually already on site. Number five, make a measurable net gain contribution. So obviously by using the DEFRA metric, you're going to be able to measure that impact that you're having, and you want to make a measurable net gain. Number six, achieve the best outcomes for biodiversity and make sure that you're actually just not, you know, not using existing wildlife areas, but you're delivering better outcomes for biodiversity than what's already there. And that leads on to number seven, which is be additional. Then you want to create net gain legacy. Think about the future and long-term benefits, the wider benefits, and again, those environmental net gain benefits that I've spoken about. Number nine, optimize sustainability. And then finally, be transparent. And again, report on what you've done, share the learning, and help other people do what they can to deliver biodiversity net gain correctly. And again, as overall, do the best for biodiversity. So our top tips for adherence are early engagement. I can't stress this enough. I think we've all said it throughout this, but early engagement is really, really helpful and really basically very critical for achieving biodiversity net gain and helping to deliver it within the budget and the plans of the development. Allow suitable budget. If you don't necessarily allow enough budget, you're going to really struggle, especially if you do have to go down the credits option. It's going to be much more difficult to achieve if you've, you know, you're going to have to do some value engineering and maybe lose other parts of the development that you wanted. Aim for on-site solutions with landscaping, following that mitigation hierarchy. So again, making sure that early engagement, you try and include the plans in the design as much as possible and to deliver that on-site option by avoiding impacting any of the biodiversity as much as possible, minimizing the duration, intensity, and extent of the impact, and then improve any degraded or removed ecosystems, and then finally offset. Another really key one here is know your portfolio and land ownership, and then maintain it. So we actually had an example of a customer who had some land that they wanted us to develop on, but it wasn't being maintained between the time that they got ownership of that land and before we took ownership of it. And in that time, it almost became a priority habitat. So it's really, really key to make sure that you're maintaining any land that you own if you're going to want to develop on it, and ensure that the baseline for that biodiversity net gain assessment is actually from the best place, really. And then finally, link up with local landowners, working with local people that you know, local councils or local planning authorities, local nature areas, and making sure that you can try and deliver those off-site solutions if necessary. And also thinking about enhancing connectivity between areas. So that's, again, going to deliver the best chances for biodiversity. So biodiversity net gain in action. Have a couple of case studies here for you, highlighting the different routes available. So this route is an on-site BNG for a refurbishment that we did. So for our customer, Brighton and Hove City Council, there was a refurbishment project delivering BNG through a new sensory garden and outdoor space. So this was actually a former school that was being turned into an office space, and we delivered end user gains, improved health and well-being, workplace performance and learning outcomes. And one of the really great things about this project was it was actually created through a Wilmot Dixon volunteering day. So this was something that a lot of our people joined together, and working with our supply chain as well, went to help deliver this great new space for our customer, which delivered an 11% biodiversity net gain, 39% habitat net gain, and a 90% hedgerow net gain. So all great. So this next example is another one for on-site BNG, but this was these are both just regular regular buildings. Not really regular buildings, really, but as regular as they can be. So these are two projects that we're doing for Lincolnshire County Council, both on site at the moment. So St. Lawrence SEND School. And for this project, we are planting additional trees, wildflowers, grassland and hedgerow, delivering 9.63% habitat net gain and 216% hedgerow net gain. So I would like to state that I know that that's not achieving the 10% required, but this was before the planning requirement. And it's just something that we wanted to measure and try and achieve as much as possible. So still great. And then the Sleaford Secure Children's Home, which is aiming to be net zero carbon in operation also, is going to be achieving 57% habitat net gain and 16.45% hedgerow net gain. So this is an example where we've actually also, you know, the requirement isn't necessarily there for planning, but the local authority would actually like us to try and achieve it. So we've been going backwards and forwards to try and make sure that we can do that with the landscape architect. Okay, so this one is a slightly different route that we could mention. So this was an off-site biodiversity net gain. So again, this is before the requirements have come in, obviously. So we were working with Rushcliffe Borough Council to deliver Bingham Arena and Enterprise Centre, which is a low-carbon facility for the local community. And because there was going to be an on-site loss of 4.99 biodiversity units, we worked with the customer and they have found a local park where they're going to, they've delivered a wildflower meadow habitat that's been created and will be maintained by their local authority as well, which is great. Okay, so just to highlight the importance of engaging specialists early. So we as a contractor can add value during the early stages and feasibility of a scheme. So we can work with you to develop the biodiversity net gain plan to ensure the planning process actually runs as smoothly as possible. We can help your team to understand biodiversity net gain and help upskill them with webinars like this or other sessions. We can find ways to incorporate BNG on site, working with our design teams and suggesting the best solutions for your budget. So actually thinking about what we want you to, what you want to deliver and how we can help you achieve that, and thinking about also the program, the building users and the environment. We can identify potential challenges. So working with you very early on is going to help stop those challenges from becoming a problem later on. So for example, with the example of the customer owning the land and making sure that that area continues to be maintained before we take over that site. We can open possibilities to extend BNG to environmental net gain. So again, we want to think about how we can deliver the best options for the environment. So helping to provide natural cooling, maybe with trees, shade, flood protection, thinking about that sustainable urban drainage design, and improved air and water quality as well. So, you know, delivering the best for the environment and our local areas. So we can assist with partnerships with local wildlife bodies and landowners for off-site solutions. And finally, we can introduce you to suitable ecologists such as EMEC, who can then help deliver, again, the best options for your project. Then we can also work with ecologists such as EMEC, and they can help mitigate any risks and delays. So once engaged on your project, the ecologist will map the habitats present on the site and record their condition to get that baseline, and they'll determine the baseline biodiversity score. They can advise whether off-site biodiversity units are required, and then they can detail any irreplaceable habitat. So like I said about ancient woodland that can't be replaced. So they can then detail any other ecological factors such as protected species and invasive non-native species. And they can input into the outline design, ensuring biodiversity net gain requirements are considered, and hopefully deliver the best project that you can get.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone.
Yeah, we're all back. I'll move us swiftly on to the questions now. We've had quite a few come through, so we'll get through as many as we can. The first one we've got is, could you explain the spatial risk multiplier again, please? Alice, I think, are you able to pick that one up?
Yes, that's fine. So basically, as Laura was saying, depending on if you can't achieve your net gain on site and then you're looking for your off-site option, if you're looking at an area off-site that is within the same local planning authority as your development, then if you're having to purchase one credit to get up to your 10% net gain, then that one unit will cost the same as one credit. So for example, if that's to replace a low distinctiveness habitat, that's gonna cost you however much that costs based on that scale that Laura showed. However, if you can't find any off-site units to purchase within the same local planning authority and you have to look outside, either with an adjacent or completely separate authority, it's essentially going to be more expensive to purchase those units. So within a completely different local planning authority, one unit actually costs double. It costs two credits. So that's the incentive to keep it local and kind of make sure you're maintaining that habitat connectivity and then benefiting local habitats.
Brilliant, thank you. Someone's just asked about slides, and yeah, you'll all be getting a copy of the slide deck and a recording of the presentation probably tomorrow afternoon, so that's not a problem. Another question we've had come in, what has to be done during the 30 years that the land is secured for, and what happens after 30 years? Simone, are you all right to pick that one up?
Yes, that's fine. So the land does need to be managed for the entire of that 30 years and needs to be maintained in accordance with the habitat management plan that's been created as part of the whole planning submission. But then after the 30 years, it is fine for that land to be developed in a different way. But there will likely be incentives for this to be continued to be used for biodiversity net gain and continue delivering better benefits for the environment. It's also worth noting that if the land has been used for woodland that's been created, then this is basically a permanent land use change, and you will not be able to deliver anything other than woodland after that point.
Yep. The next one we have is around securing offsite credit. So how do you secure offsite credit before a planning application is accepted? Laura or Alice, are you right to pick that one up, please?
Yeah, I can do that one. So offsite net gain, it'd either be achieved on land owned by the developer themselves, or land which has been purchased or locked into a 30-year lease. And then you can also purchase land / units from a habitat bank to offset losses on site. So habitat banks is basically land that's there available, and you would approach the habitat bank with your metric and say, like, we need X amount of units, and the sort of spatial risk, the spatial variations that Alice was speaking about earlier, they apply for habitat banks as well. So the opportunities for enhancement and creation of habitats on offsite land, they'd be assessed and implemented in the metric by the ecologist, and they'll work to achieve that 10% or the net gain. And the offsite enhancements and achievable units will be agreed between the developer and the ecologist prior to submission. And then once it's submitted, the LPA will review the offsite measures. I think it's important as well to just clarify that offsite net gain and the statutory credits are different. So offsite units are achieved in the ways I've just mentioned. Statutory credits are different, so they're a last resort, basically, if neither on-site or offsite net gain can be achieved.
Okay. Brilliant. Thanks, Laura. It's quite a long question here. Do you have any idea how BNG could be applied when there is only a limited duration lease, for example, 10 years, but an opportunity for considerable biodiversity improvement? For example, available farmland adjacent to a development site where the development site itself has very limited opportunity for improvement. Alice, can you pick that one up?
Yeah, so in order for land to be to qualify for BNG, whether it's on site or off site, it has to be secured for that 30 years. So obviously that does mean that if it can only be secured for 10 years, then unfortunately it can't be included in that biodiversity net gain calculation. You know, obviously it's still really valuable to be able to do as many biodiversity enhancements as you can on that land within that development. We'd still really encourage that. But yeah, there would have to be alternative options looked at to achieve the 10% net gain.
Okay, thanks. Then we've got Simone, this one's best for you. Could this 10% requirement increase in the future, and is it the maximum that we have to deliver?
No, it's definitely not the maximum, and yes, it can increase in the future. You know, 10% is the minimum requirement for what has to be delivered, so if you can achieve more than that, then definitely deliver much more than that. And there are definitely already local planning authorities that are asking for more than 10%. So yeah, it's very likely that this will increase in the future.
Fab, thank you. And another one for you, Alice, I'm afraid. What are the validation implications?
Sorry, Liz. Could you explain a bit more about what you mean about validation?
Oh, that was just something that somebody had put, just a question somebody had put in. So if that was you, can you elaborate a little bit more on the question, and we'll pick that up at the end. Thanks. Okay, we'll move on to this one. How does BNG deal with contaminated land in the metric? And contaminated in this case relates to Japanese knotweed. Who's best placed for that one? That'd be Alice or Laura.
Oh, sorry, I muted myself. rookie mistake. yeah, I can take that one. So basically, Schedule 9 invasive species don't have their own habitat in the metric, so it's not a assigned habitat classification. But the presence of invasive species is included on some of the habitat's condition assessments, whereby like removing that non-native invasive species will improve habitat condition, or is likely to improve the condition. But for things like Japanese knotweed, where the ground's considered contaminated, and often to remove Japanese knotweed involves, you know, excavating the land, and you've often got large stands of it, that there will not be much left of the habitat if you just remove that, just remove the species. So it would go down as a loss of units, as a loss of habitat units. It would usually be assigned a habitat that's closely matches it, maybe like introduced shrub or similar sort of habitat, and then it would go down as removal of habitat. That could then be replaced with something native, so mixed scrub in like moderate or good condition, depending on what condition it could feasibly achieve, which would then result in a gain overall for that area. But yeah, the removal of Japanese knotweed on its own, it wouldn't automatically achieve an increase in net gain units, in biodiversity units, sorry.
Okay, thanks. Simone, there's been a question here come in about one of the case studies. I think it was the Bingham Arena. And it's asking, what's the difference between 10% net gain and the 4.9 credits loss? Are they two different metrics?
Okay, yeah, I probably should have explained that one a little bit more. So the units is basically dependent on the baseline of the project, and it doesn't really matter whether you've, you know, you could have 2 units on the site already and you'll need to then deliver 10% more than that finally. So the 10% is the wider explanation of the what the units, I'm not explaining this well. the units basically give the idea of how you achieve the 10%. I don't know if I explained that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, we'll soon find out. If somebody wants to ask some more clarifications, please put that forward. So another one here, what is the cutoff for BNG to be required? For example, if a project has already been validated by planners before February the 12th, will it still need to meet BNG? Laura, you're right to pick that one up.
So if it's being submitted before the 14th of Feb, the LPA will tell you whether you sort of need to achieve 10% or, you know, what you need to achieve with that development.
Okay. And the next one I think is probably best for you as well, Laura. Do you advocate looking for the best outcome or just aiming for the 10%? What should be the priority?
So yeah, we always sort of advocate for as much gain as is achievable on site, just because it's good for biodiversity as a whole. We work closely with our clients to achieve the best gain for sort of biodiversity, to also sort of coincide with their development plan and their budget.
Okay, I've got a lot of questions coming in still. If we can create extra BNG on a project, for example, more than 10%, does that mean we can sell our credits on? I'm just wondering if this creates a financial opportunity to go and be above and beyond the minimum statutory requirement. Is that?
I can take that as well.
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, that is a good question. It's one I've been asked before by clients, but it's difficult because you can't transfer units to a different site. If land is being used to have net gain on a particular development, it then can't be transferred. Like if you get over your 10%, say you get 25%, you can't then transfer the other 15% to another site. So yeah, unfortunately, it wouldn't be able to be transferred. It has to be the land that could be sold. For example, if you sort of chopped off a bit of your site and still got 10% in most of your site, and then you had that little bit of extra land, it could then be used for a different development, as long as it was aside from, like, completely not meant, like, not used at all in this other development. So it has to be new land, if that makes sense. Which it could, I'm not fully sure on how you would, like, how registering as a habitat bank and stuff like that works, but I think you have to register it, or it could be done privately. So as long as that land hasn't been used in your development, then you could sell it. You set it aside to sell it. But yeah, it's not a case of, you know, taking the extra from the 10% and then selling it that way, if that makes sense. The roundabout way of saying it, sorry.
We've had a question in about the housing site case study, Laura, that you spoke about. And they've said, in the first housing site case study, where modified grassland was predominantly replaced with houses and gardens, was it possible to realise a net gain?
So I personally didn't work on that site. I think you did, Alice. And I think that site did get a gain from, I think that site did get 10% gain, didn't it, from the enhancements that we put in?
Yes, it did in the end. It went through, as Laura said, it went through multiple iterations, just because the main reason we hadn't been involved from the beginning, which again puts the stress on, you know, get an ecologist in to do your baseline as soon as possible, because then, you know, if we come in once the final development plan is pretty much finalized, then it can be very difficult to shoehorn in any biodiversity gain on site. But yeah, as you could see from that plan, a lot of the site had been, you know, set aside for private dwellings and private gardens, which, you know, had to be put down as vegetated gardens, which doesn't really deliver many habitat units at all. So yeah, we had to use, they did reduce the number of houses that they were putting on there just so they could achieve the net gain on site, because in that case, yeah, they didn't really have the option to do any off-site enhancements.
Thank you. And Simone, one for you. Who is primarily responsible for acting on biodiversity net gain for a particular project?
Well, technically it's the customer, I believe, but it's whoever's really trying to deliver on those planning conditions. So if it's a planning, it's a planning requirement, so it will be everybody really. But I'd say it's the customer's ultimate responsibility.
Yeah, okay. So is biodiversity net gain applicable for refurbishment projects that need listed building consent? Is anyone able to pick that up? Is that Amek or Simone?
No, I don't know that we've worked on any so far, so it's not something that we've experienced, though.
Yeah.
I suppose I can't see any reason why not. If it requires planning permission, then it's going to be subject to BNG.
Yeah. We'll double check on that and we can clarify that in the follow-up email tomorrow. The question, so here's one here, quite specific question here on a school project. So we're working on a project where site works, i.e. line markings and drainage to a school pitch, are going to cause a project to be a major application due to the size. Does that mean BNG applies to this scheme?
Sorry, could you repeat the question, please, Louise?
Yeah, sure. So we're working on a project where site works, i.e. line markings and drainage to a school pitch, are going to cause a project to be a major application due to the size of it. Will biodiversity net gain still apply?
I think the short answer is yes. Once the 14th of February comes around and BNG becomes mandatory, it will apply to most major developments, with the exceptions of the very small ones that Laura outlined.
Okay. I've got another one here. So we've got, could you please describe the difference between a landscape management plan and a habitat management plan, and who is responsible for preparing that?
Yeah, so I was going to say that the habitat management plan is a BNG specific plan that's demonstrating that you'll get from your baseline to your proposed habitat enhancement, and it lasts for 30 years. A landscape management plan, again, it's not something that us as ecologists are making, but it doesn't tie into that legal framework to get yourself planning permission, whereas the HMMP, the Habitat Maintenance and Monitoring Plan, will.
Great. We've got another one here about, where can we find out about the cost of BNG offsetting credits? Simone, you right to pick that one up?
Yeah, that's fine. That is all available on the government website. So if you just Google biodiversity statutory credits, you'll see the full list of all of the costs for the different types of habitats for that.
Great. And we've got one here that's, in terms of habitat creation, what type of habitat creates the most BNG credit? Are we heading into an area where vertical habitats are created to maximise more credits from a small land footprint, such as vertical farms, for example? Sounds like an EMAC question.
Oh, go on, Ben.
I was going to say, do you all take it? But yeah, I think there's that the where that kind of market lies is that developers that need to be exchanging like for like or better. So that market for BNG units is going to be what's being lost. And then in terms of vertical farms and how those habitats would tie into the metric and what UK Hab assessment there'd be, I'm not too sure they'd be of that high value, or if, yeah, that there'd even be the demand in the marketplace to want to buy them.
And just jumping in on the question about which sort of habitat delivers the most units, it's really, it's not a simple thing. It's not kind of like there's one be all and end it all habitat that's like the best one to create. It's kind of, it's very subjective, based on what you had on your site before, and what you've lost. So if you have lots of, you know, if you've got some woodland on your site and you're losing some of that woodland, then you really want to replace that woodland. Or, well, the first thing you'd want to do is not impact the woodland, but then say, you know, you are impacting the woodland, you would should then really replace the woodland to then not have a loss in woodland habitats. So there's an additional thing with BNG. I won't go into it too much because it's quite complicated, but there's the trading rules as well. So the trading rules basically divides the habitats into groups, and you need to have a gain or not a loss in each of the groups for the trading rules to be satisfied. So the short answer is it depends on what's on your site to begin with. There are some habitats that score higher that would be good to use, like the higher value grasslands or woodlands and stuff like that. But yeah, it does depend on what you've got already.
Cool. Thanks, Laura. We've got one here, maybe this one's for you, Jono. What's the difference between BNG and ENG? I hear them talked about together and not quite clear the differences.
It's a good question. So BNG is the team we've talked about, biodiversity net gain, and then ENG stands for environmental net gain, which is sort of where I see the industry going, and where Wilmot Dixon is aligned for our 2030 ambitions to deliver. So ENG is effectively going above and beyond biodiversity. So you're thinking more than just about the species and the habitats. You're thinking about the wider air pollution, climate change effect on communities, health and well-being. It's sort of an all-encompassing trajectory or target we're working towards. And we've started on, there's a couple of tools, industry tools that you can use, and we've started trialing it on it. They're a bit sort of work in progress at the moment. They're in sort of beta phase of testing. But it's quite exciting to see the impact you have. You think you're doing good for BNG, but you've got to take into account all the other aspects when you build a building. So we're certainly going to start reporting those figures in the years to come. But keep an eye on the ENG. BNG is sort of the mandatory one for now, but ENG, I think, is where we as an industry are going to start heading.
Can I just add to that, just to help people understand like what ENG is in comparison, is that it's more like wider impact, so flood defence or flood protection, air quality, like thinking about if anyone knows about like the natural resources that that the environment actually provides for us, if that helps.
Thanks, Simone. And we've got one here. How are you to be held responsible or accountable for maintenance if you don't own the land for off-site biodiversity net gain? It's best for that one.
So in that instance, let's say you've gone to a habitat bank, they're providing the units that you're using as offset for your development. I think is the end person that's held accountable for that is you, in order to put in a reputable company and a reputable habitat bank. But that the responsible body, so the LPA, will be managing that and keeping up to date with it, with the progress of the habitats against HMNP, through going directly to the habitat bank and checking their land.
Thanks, Ben. Another one here. So how would you manage the spatial risk manager, spatial risk multiplier, I think that means, for a linear site across multiple local planning authorities?
Any thoughts on that one?
That is a good question. don't know whether it would be a case of the individual parts going to the respective LPAs and then it being managed that way. What do you think, Ben or Alice?
Yeah, I suppose that would be a complex question for a large and complex site, and realistically it's going to be managed by getting environmental consultants on board early and liaising with the relevant LPAs throughout that site, and allowing the project to take steer through that engagement with those different LPAs and through the ecologist to do a baseline of the full site.
Thanks. I think this will probably be our last question now. We've covered most of them. Who is responsible for enforcing post-development BNG compliance, and how do you check whether the land has a restricting covenant?
So as the developer or the landowner, it would be you that would be responsible for the 30-year management and ensure that it's managed in the right way as per the management plan to achieve like the habitats and the condition that was agreed with on the BNG and put through submission. Could you just repeat the second part of that question again, Louise? Sorry.
Sure, one second. Where's that gone? So how do you check whether the land has a restricting covenant?
I was going to say that as you engage the solicitors and you're drawing up that document with your habitat bank, is that your solicitors are going to do due diligence and searches to ensure that there are no restricting covenants, such as there's a mortgage in place on the land or something like that.
There was a good bit about that question about who checks it, though. I'm not sure we covered that bit about who checks whether we maintain the developers or landowners are checking it.
So I think it's the responsible body, effectively, are the people that have to check that, and that's the LPA. At the moment, in most places, it's the LPA. The LPA has the ability to delegate that to a responsible body, though I'm not aware of any in the areas that we're working at the moment where that's actually happened yet. And so that responsible body will likely be a wildlife charity. There's on the government website, there's a form up there on how you can actually apply to become a responsible body. And from that, you can take a bit of a steer and go, this is going to end up with wildlife charities. But for now, it's the LPA.
Thanks for listening. If you have any questions or would like to talk to us about how BNG applies to a particular project that you're working on, please get in touch via our website, www.wilmotdixon.co.uk.